Good afternoon or good evening, and welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio, the podcast where we talk with writers about their lives, their craft, their business, and their latest work. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and our podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks. Bookmarks is a literary nonprofit whose programs include the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas. Come visit Bookmarks at our community gathering space and nonprofit independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. My guest today is Elaine Neal Orr, whose novel Swimming Between Worlds was published earlier this month. I first met Elaine at the Bookmarks Festival in 2013 when we discussed her first novel, A Different Sun. Like that book, Swimming Between Worlds makes connections between the American South and the continent of Africa, though in this new novel in a very different and very beautiful way. Elaine, welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio.
Thank you, Charlie.
Let's explore for a few minutes this connection your novels have in looking at the strands that tie Africa to the American South. How has that connection played out in your own life?
Well, as you know, Charlie, I was born in Nigeria. My parents were missionaries, and so my earliest memories are all of Nigeria. Mm-hmm. My first memory of the U.S. was in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, when I was in the first grade, in the year that this novel is set. But in Nigeria, in Yoruba land, which is where I grew up, there's an idea of shaping the child's head, which is really like the soul. And so I like to say that my head was shaped in Nigeria. And but of course, by now I've been on this continent for a good long while. So obviously, for me, the connection is very strong. We would be in Nigeria 3 years, have a furlough, come to the American South, go back to Nigeria. But in my adult life and in my writing, I've come to explore the way these two regions are connected, not just for me personally, but for multitudes of people, because of the way that enslaved people were brought from West Africa to the South,
right,
and so influenced the culture here.
So you posted, I was following your Facebook post since the book came out, and you posted something the other day. I thought this was just a great quote that I would love for you to unpack for us a little bit. You said, "I never felt like a hometown girl in the United States, but now I do, and this will never happen again." Can you give us the spark notes on that quote?
Certainly. I do feel like I think it was in reference to getting two stories in the NNO in Raleigh in as many Sundays. So that really made me feel at home and welcomed. And I do think that now I do feel, I don't think this is a fleeting moment. I think, though, really with this book, which is set in Winston-Salem and not in Raleigh, that I've reconciled something by claiming this town, actually, mm-hmm. Winston-Salem, which I lived in only 1 year, but you can probably recall your first grade year. It's a momentous time. And a year for a child is enough time to soak up a world, right? And so I have felt often like the stranger here because my perspective is still, in many ways, originating in Nigeria.
Yeah. And so you live in Raleigh now and teach at North Carolina State, is that right?
That's right. Yeah. I've been there for, I could say decades now.
So you mentioned the book is set in Winston-Salem. It opens in 1959 and goes on into 1960. And in writing this book, you're conjuring up not only the city that you lived in when you were in first grade, but the city I was born in. I was born in Winston-Salem in 1962, so just after the time that your book is set. And with the exception of the few fictional landmarks in your book, there is not a street or a landmark that I do not recognize. I mean, I was reading this book, and I went to visit friends, and I suddenly realized that we were across the street from the house that Tacker lives in. You know,
are you kidding?
The morning I was reading. So you've talked about this a little bit, that you said you chose Winston-Salem in 1959 because that's when you were here. But can you delve into a little bit deeper about why Winston-Salem in 1959 made a particularly interesting place to set this story?
Well, It was in part happen chance. I mean, I had written two books. I wrote my memoir, which is set largely in Nigeria. It's my girlhood primarily, set against a significant adult illness from which I recovered. And then the first novel was set in Yoruba land, which is now Nigeria, in 1850. So I thought, Elaine, your readers might want an American novel. Maybe you should think about putting at least the majority of the story in the U.S.
Right.
And so then I thought, well, then let's just make it a North Carolina novel. Okay. And I didn't want to write about Raleigh. I don't have those tender feelings that I do about Winston-Salem. So I conjured that house, and it was such a profound experience living in that four square on the corner of Jarvis and Weston Boulevard and walking every day to Brunson.
So is that actually the house that you lived in?
It was actually the house we lived in.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I have friends who live right across the street. It was bizarre to visit them and realize, wait a minute, I think it's that house right there.
Exactly. It's painted blue right
yep,
now.
That's the one.
Yeah. I've tried to get in. The guy won't let me in. So I had, it was just a very sweet year, and it was this, just this imprinting of the United States and the American South, Camellias, sleet, television for the first time, Chef Boyardee, Coca-Cola's, all these things, both popular culture and the geography of the landscape, and then these iconic places like Peters Creek and Haynes Park, where they were for me, I mean, as a young girl. And so I think we shopped at that grocery that was a it's no longer a grocery. I believe it's now, it was most recently a restaurant.
Yeah.
So that's why I chose it, and I didn't even have characters. I just knew the place.
So you began with setting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's a very rich setting, not only, and the time period, of course, we're going to talk about that in just a minute. I spent many years living in a house about two blocks from the house that you're talking about. So I know the neighborhood very well, and it's a neighborhood that, like many neighborhoods in America, has had its ups and downs. It was the original sort of suburb of Winston in the early 20th century, and then it kind of got to be really run down, and now it's, you know, it's a much nicer place. But I think you're there in 1959, sort of right when it's on the edge of starting to be not as nice a neighborhood.
Exactly.
And so it's an interesting time to explore.
Yes. I at some point in the novel, I comment on, from Tacker's perspective, Tacker Hart is the protagonist.
Yep.
There's a female protagonist as well, but his story is the germ. His story is really where it begins. Mm-hmm. And he thinks that the neighborhood is beginning to fray a little around the edges, but that fits his mood.
Yeah.
Because he's feeling disoriented and out of place for the first time in his life after being overseas and coming home.
Right. So tell us the basic setup of the novel and the situation where we find Tacker in at the beginning of the novel.
Okay, so at the beginning, he's, I guess it's 59, and it's the fall of 59. He's come back to Winston-Salem, having once been the sort of the star athlete, the golden boy of the high school, Reynolds.
Was he at Reynolds High School? Yeah.
Reynolds High. He's owned the town in a way, right? And he's gone to State College, School of Design. He's an aspiring architect. And he won this prestigious award to go to West Africa and collaborate on a design for high schools that will be built around the nation. But he's accused by his sponsor of going native. He's gone overboard, fallen in love with the culture, left his head where he's supposed to live and gone to live with the Nigerian men and other sorts of things. So he comes back discouraged, disoriented, and decides to, because he doesn't know what to do, to manage his father's grocery. So that's what he's doing one morning, walking to work, when he runs into Gaines, the African-American character, mm-hmm. who's home for a different reason, but has been at Fisk University and is involved in the civil rights movement.
Right.
And then the young woman, Kate, knew Tacker in high school, but they were 2 years apart, and they were in different paths. She was a scholar, he was an athlete.
Right.
So they all converge in this neighborhood, but in different ways and with different results.
Tacker has very different relationships with the Africans he knows in Nigeria and with the African Americans he comes into contact with Winston-Salem. And part of the reason he has these different relationships are the cultures that he's in, what kind of relationship is allowed. Did you experience that, those different kinds of relationships in your own life?
Absolutely. In Nigeria, of course, we went to church with Nigerians. We did have a compound, but it was crisscrossed by paths through the town. And so we were rubbing shoulders with Nigerians all the time. We stayed in Nigerian homes. The pastor of our church was a Nigerian. And I didn't go to a Nigerian school. In many ways, which I had, but I didn't. But there was a great deal of back and forth and interaction. And even when I go back to Nigeria now, which I do, it's we're all together. We eat together. We stay together in the same homes. So my memory, though, is of coming to Nigeria later in the ninth grade and entering an American high school and realizing that there was no way to bridge this chasm. That was the first time I even heard about race.
Yeah.
Was in the ninth grade. We never talked about that in Nigeria.
Mm-hmm. Something really popped out when I was reading the press release, which I didn't read until after. I always like to read the book first, and then I read all the other bits and pieces. But it begins with this question, when you leave home, can you ever really come back again? And I think of that question as almost a cornerstone of Southern literature, and certainly harkens back to Thomas Wolfe's You Can't Go Home Again. How would you say you explore that question of can you go home again in this novel?
Yes, I don't know that I knew that I was exploring that. It's always lovely when people read your books and tell you what you've done. So it's absolutely a central question for Tacker, and he can't come home as he was. He's forever changed. And anyone would be in this era, and even now, who left North Carolina, some person, young person, who'd never been out of the American South, who went and lived in Nigeria for a year and a half with Nigerians, it would be shattering and revelatory, both. And so he can't. And in a way, Kate is also changed when she discovers a secret about her parents, and she can't come home in the way that she was at home, even though she's living in her family home, because her parents are both dead. So it's true of both characters that they really can't, and I think that's why many people are calling it a coming-of-age novel, because even though they're in their 20s, they've reached this moment of maturity and adulthood, and they're having to respond to a moral question.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting how they, every now and then we sort of flash back to the ways that they didn't interact in high school, you know, passing in a hallway or something, and to see the difference between someone in their, you know, mid-20s versus somebody who's in high school, blocks away, the same town, and yet a completely different kind of worldview for both of them and different kind of relationship. Would you read us a little excerpt from the novel?
Sure. So one thing we haven't talked about yet, but that will come up for anyone who takes a look at this book, is that it has to do with the a central conflict is the sit-ins. In North Carolina, in Greensboro first, and then in Winston-Salem. They were in Charlotte as well. And I didn't know this until I started writing the novel, or until I chose to write the novel and set it here. And I was looking for a conflict, and this is what I found. So I'm not going to read the whole sit-in section. That would be too long. But this is an interesting moment, I think, because it introduces us to some cultural shifts that have occurred, not just for this family, but for all American families. Okay. 1st of February, Tacker and his parents sat at the dining table. He'd come over to help his dad hook up a new washing machine and stayed for spaghetti supper. It was so much easier to visit them now that he had at least the outline of his life back. He thought he might mention Kate if the right moment showed itself. The television was turned to the news. It was a new ritual with Tacker's parents to watch the news during dinner. Their stainless flatware clinked against the everyday plates. His mother refilled their water glasses. David Brinkley's face, with its slightly tilted mouth, filled the screen. He was talking about North Carolina. In a moment, shifting images of a lunch counter came into focus, a gaggle of angry people. And then four Negroes were in the spotlight, a reporter talking with one of them. "What do you hope to accomplish?" The four men were dressed in coats and ties, but other than that, they looked so different from one another, it was difficult to comprehend what the story was about. "We want to sit down at the counter and pay for a cup of coffee and a plate of food," one said. Another of the men leaned toward the microphone. "We come in and make our purchase. The cashier takes our money, but if we get hungry, we can't order food and sit down to eat. We have to go all the way back home to eat or stand in the street. It's not fair." The footage of the four men cut off and the screen switched back to David Brinkley in the studio. Tacker was still hearing the second man who had spoken. "We have to go all the way home to eat." He placed his hands on the table as a wave of excitement and doubt swept over him.
That's very nice. I love that you used the television there because, you know, we just watched this documentary about the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's death.
Exactly.
And one of the things they talked about a lot was that the civil rights movement couldn't have happened without the television coverage.
Exactly.
And that this was the same moment when they went from 15 minutes of news at night to 30 minutes. You know, now, of course, we have 24 hours a day.
Exactly.
Sort of, one of the things I found really interesting in this novel, again, especially as a young man who grew up in Winston-Salem, not too much after this, you have white characters who are very sympathetic to the civil rights movement, especially Tacker. But then you also have white characters who are more ambivalent. Of course, we see a little bit more from a distance those characters who are really, you know, still very much stuck in their racist ways. But I'm curious especially about, and I think of Kate in particular, about how do you write a white character who feels ambivalent about the civil rights movement but is still likable to a reader in 2018?
Well, I hope I accomplished that. I found Kate much harder to write.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
In part, because I knew Tacker's story. It's in many ways my story. Not that I started here and went to Nigeria, but that I have this perspective of coming back
right,
here.
Right, right.
Okay. And so Kate is the one who's much more ambivalent. She sees Gaines one morning walking in her alley, and she's fearful and has all those stereotypical fears. Oh, he's going to jump into my yard. He's going to attack me. He's mm-hmm. going to come into my mm-hmm. house. He's going to violate me, right? That horrible myth of black men that was created in the South after the Civil War. So I had to make her sympathetic. Well, one way I did that, I guess, is by having her parents dead. And so she's lonely. But I think the primary way, Charlie, was that I created her as a character who understands she might not be as good a person as she would like to be. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that the metaphor I use of she feels a cool lozenge in the right?
Yeah, and that comes back
chamber
several
of
times.
Her heart.
Yeah.
Right, and so she's aware that she has been raised to be good, to be a moral person, but that she may lack some core empathy.
Yeah.
And so that's her journey to figure that out.
So there were scenes in this novel that felt like they came out of my own life. And my father was widowed when I was 2 years old. I had an older brother and sister, so there were three of us. And so he hired an African-American woman to come to the house, and she got us up in the morning and fixed us breakfast and cleaned the house and did the laundry and
sure.
was with us for many, many years. And to us, she felt like a part of our family, and yet we all always understood that we weren't really a part of her family, that there was this sort of mysterious, unknown to us world that she went back to
right
at the end. And you have a scene where Tacker goes to a funeral, which we had that same experience. We went to her funeral. We were the only white people in the church, and it was sort of this eye-opening thing that, well, we knew there was this whole other world in her life, but but as a child, I never really thought about it or really saw it. And yet we felt like there was an emotional connection between her life and our lives. And I guess my question is, for those of us who grew up in that kind of situation, how in your novel do you get at the ways that we dealt with those emotional connections and tried to make the two cultures less alien to each other?
Well, two things I want to say. One thing I want to say is that paradigm was also adopted on the mission field. So we had Nigerian servants in our home. There were always men, though, because these men were aspiring to something else. And so they would come work for missionaries and make a pretty good wage, comparatively speaking, and then often convince the missionary to send them to pharmacy school.
Yeah.
So my parents sent a number of these young men onto school, and they then achieved bright futures. That was not the paradigm here. Generally, if someone hired a Negro person to work for them, they didn't then end up sending them to gain a higher education.
Right.
So it was similar and different. One of the ways that I bridge that in this novel is, of course, by bringing it, I don't know if I'm going to give away too much about the plot, but there's a connection between Gaines and the family maid. And
yeah.
So through Gaines, Tacker gains a completely different kind of awareness of what we might call Negro life.
Right?
He's had this idea about Negro life, which would pretty much resign people to, working on tobacco fields, maybe working in somehow with tobacco in town, being maids, being yard men, but they would have been called yard boys. Francis can't even come, the family maid can only come into the grocery he works in because she's a maid. But it's through Gaines, I think. This man his own age, maybe a few years younger, but who acts like a peer with him, that he gains a different insight. And then going to the funeral, having revealed to him this whole other world that he didn't know about. And still, I think his feeling for Francis is absolutely genuine. I don't mean to undermine that. I think he has an enormous gratitude for her. He just didn't really know her in a complete way.
And I think one of the things that I think this book accomplishes is one of the ways, and in Winston-Salem, of course, we had Maya Angelou, and I think it works by Toni Morrison, and I think it works by white writers too, like To Kill a Mockingbird or The Help.
Exactly.
That literature can help us bridge that gap, can help us understand a culture that, even though it is in the same town that we're in, on the surface of it, seems alien to us, no matter which direction we're coming from.
Exactly. I think you're right. And by the way, I have to give Toni Morrison a lot of credit for helping me write Gaines. Not that Gaines is any particular character in her novel, in any of her novels, but I've just read so many of them.
Yeah.
And I've seen what she does, and I've tried to learn from her. Trying to think of the core of the question at the moment, which is just how literature helps us cross these boundaries and go into places that we haven't. So I have Tacker enter Francis's house. Many, perhaps most Americans who had maids, African-American maids, in their homes in that era might never have gone into their home.
Sure.
Right? And so I tried to conjure her house. I went, Pham Brownlee, the wonderful Winston-Salem historian, talked to me many times and helped me find what no longer exists, which was this pocket neighborhood called Watkins, I think, neighborhood, which was not that far from West End, but it no longer exists. And I went to that space where it was and found a shotgun house. I mean, there's one left,
yeah.
Right? And I have been in them. And so I just tried to conjure what her house might look like and take him in there and have her make coffee for him. And so that those small things are actually large, I think, when we're reading and we begin to go places we haven't been.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to be curious to see how readers who didn't grow up in the South, I mean, I think this is a book that will resound any place because we all live near alien cultures. If we live in a small town, if we live in a big city, it doesn't matter.
Right.
There's always the need to try to understand the person across the street, the person next door. But it'll be interesting to see how those details play out for readers who maybe don't have the kind of background that, you know, when I'm reading a book that's set in my hometown, it's always a little difficult to get that perspective.
Right.
You know, the first person I had on this podcast had written a book about that was set in the prep school that I went to.
Oh, man.
And I could immediately tell everything that was true and everything that was made up. And it's very hard to sort of step back. So I know that readers who come from a different background, this book will resonate with them. But it'll do it in a different way, I think, which will be interesting. Kate says at one point, what one loved about literature was all of the flaws, not in the writing, but in the characters, which I think is really, there's just sentences in this book that really pop out for me. So what flaws did you enjoy giving to, especially to Tacker and Kate?
Tacker is, because he's this young American young man, who's been favored so much in life. When he goes to Nigeria, he really does step out of line a few times. When he goes to the idol burning, and he tries to correct what they're doing and say you shouldn't burn those. I mean, on the one hand, we might agree with him that these artifacts, these Christians who are trying to convince this old man to burn the family gods, that they shouldn't do that. But it's not Tacker's place to tell them, or to tell the man from Shell Oil what they should or shouldn't be doing with the Nigerian government. This is way above his pay scale.
Yeah.
Right? So he does have a high sense, or maybe an exaggerated sense of who he is, mm-hmm. though that's corrected even just by his peers when he goes to Nigeria and learns these young men know more than he does. So I guess that would be his primary flaw. Kate, she's just provincial, parochial.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know why I say just, but she is. And she doesn't, she has a classical education and knows a great deal about literature and she's read widely, but she hasn't thought outside her own sphere very much.
Yeah.
In some sense, these are flaws that we can all have, right? And they could be reversed. They're not even gender specific. So a young woman can also have much too high a view of herself, and a young man can also be parochial.
Yeah.
So they're not, I think they're recognizable flaws that we all have at some point or another, or many of us do. But they're not, Kate, for example, her flaw is not that she's too feminine or not assertive or doesn't have an idea about the world. She does. There's just many times wrong ideas.
Yeah. And I mean, to a large extent for her, it's just what she's been exposed to.
Exactly.
She hasn't seen of the world what Tacker has seen.
Exactly.
I also like that she kind of has this assumption that he's still, you know, the high school football player who doesn't want to talk to her, and she doesn't at first quite see that he has matured beyond that and has become, you know, more sensitive and in a way more insecure.
Exactly.
Which makes him open, I think, to having a relationship with her that he probably wouldn't have been open to when he thought he was all that, you know, as a high school player.
Exactly. I mean, she experienced him as a little reticent in high school because why would he need to talk to her?
Right.
She's a kind of chubby 10th grader when he's a golden football 12th grader. So football playing 12th grader. Now he's reticent, but for different reasons.
Yes. Yeah.
He's insecure. He doesn't really know. He's afraid of making mistakes in every way, not just in his professional life, but in his personal life, mm-hmm. right? And so it takes a while for them to get on the same page. It takes most of the novel.
One of the things, that always pops out at me in other people's books is when I see a line that almost was in my book.
Oh, my.
And Tacker says at one point, sometimes you, he's talking, I think, specifically about the civil rights movement. Sometimes you just have to choose what to believe. And there's a character in my novel, The Lost Book of the Grail, who says you can choose to believe. Sometimes that's all it takes, a choice. And I like, when I go to visit book clubs, I like to read that line and say, is that true? In the case of my book, it's about faith and about God, but I think it can apply either way. And so I guess my double question to you is it true? Can you just choose to believe? And then if so, how does that affect your characters?
Well, at that moment, he's talking to Kate, but I think he's talking to himself too, because he's having to make decisions about what to believe, where to place his trust, actually, even if he can place his trust. So I think, as is often the case, what we say to other people is really about ourselves,
right?
We're hoping to get affirmation. So to your question of how does this play out and how is it working with the characters, when Kate presents him with her dilemma, which is very different from his, hers is about what to believe about her family, about her parents, after she's learned something disturbing to her, and also about her father's death, something she's trying to understand about her father's death. And so he says, sometimes you just have to choose what to believe. And he's at that moment where he's, yes, also trying to figure out what he's going to believe. I'm repeating myself a little bit. I think that for all of us, maybe in almost every decade of our lives, we're having to redecide what to believe, and it's a choice. We're not really fated. We don't really have a destiny except the one we're making.
Yeah.
Things do happen to us, but we're still making our destinies. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about your process, and you mentioned that you had talked to a historian here. Did you come back to Winston-Salem early on in the process and drive around the neighborhoods?
Absolutely.
How did you sort of reincorporate your memories of 1959 Winston-Salem with the Winston-Salem you discovered more recently?
Okay, so I had been living in North Carolina probably over 20 years. Before I came back to the neighborhood, maybe 25, I had seen, because you can see from the current business I-40, that blue house on the hill. And it was like a beacon. And in some sense, I had this sense, or I had this idea that at some point I'm going to go back and look at that house. But it wasn't really until I decided to write the novel. And I drove over, it seems to me it was in the spring, and a friend here in town, Laura Giovanelli, kind of took me around. I could find the house, but I couldn't really find my way all around Haynes Park. I mean, you know, it's all curvilinear and crazy, and 4th Street and 1st Street converge. it's wild. But then I started coming back, and every season I just came back and back and back and walked in the neighborhood, and really I wanted to be here in every season to see what plants were here, what it looked like, how it smelled. And there's not the tobacco smell anymore.
No, that's something I really associate with my childhood. On certain days when the wind was right in the fall, and they were cutting tobacco in chopping it up in the factory, and the smell was just... I never cared for the smell of that stuff on fire, but when it's raw, it has this very rich autumnal aroma that kind of defined our city in those days. I was talking to somebody about Southern literature in general, and specifically about why, although I am a Southerner and I write literature, I don't consider myself a Southern writer, you know, with a capital S. And this person said, well, what ties together true Southern literature is this theme of the relationship between people and the land. We were talking about John Ealy and other writers. And I guess my question for you is, do you think that's true? And by that definition, do you think of yourself as a Southern author?
Really, I have not, though I can certainly see how this novel might... how this might be called a Southern novel. But especially because Nigeria has figured so largely in my writing, I have not really thought that way, though my parents were Southern Baptist and we spent our furloughs in the American South. But I felt that I was addressing something, I want to say larger, though I don't mean to say that Southern literature isn't large.
Sure. Yeah.
Right? I mean, how can you be larger than Faulkner?
Yeah.
But I've had this international thing going,
yeah.
Right? I've
yeah.
been Nigeria, the west coast of Africa, and the east coast of the United States, the South. And this relationship has a long history between these two coasts. Mm-hmm. But that's very Southern, as it turns out, right? Now, as far as place and the land, I was very conscious that I wanted to take Tacker out on his motorcycle and see the fields
yeah.
and the ponds and the cows. It was very intentional because I love that about North Carolina.
Yeah, yeah.
I love to get out and drive around and take the you know, the little roads mm-hmm. and discover those hills and creeks and all of that. Was very, very important to me.
Yeah.
I think, though, because land was so important to me in Nigeria, I was growing up not in big cities, but in savannas and rainforests and where there was a lot of forest and field and farmland, right? And so I think my relation to the land actually originates there.
In Nigeria.
But it's transferred here, and I love North Carolina. I mean, I love driving to the beach, which I have my characters
yeah,
do.
Yeah.
I love driving to the mountains. I just, yes, this feeling of the beauty of the land is very, very strong.
I think there's this interesting contrast between Tacker, who is renting a house. He goes, as you said, goes out into the countryside on his motorcycle. He seems somewhat untethered.
Mm-hmm.
And Kate, who is living in the house that she inherited from her parents who have passed away, and who feels, to me, very tethered.
Right.
You know, like she almost feels like she can't leave that house.
Right.
But also, with Kate, I saw a lot more of what you alluded to earlier, which is just the descriptions of the flora of Winston-Salem, the camellias
right.
and the daffodils and everything, which again, are so much a part of what makes this city what it is. So I really liked that contrast between I almost saw it like the New South and the Old South, you know, that Kate just feels anchored.
Right.
And Tacker seems to be, obviously he's been to Nigeria and he's kind of sort of takes that ability to move around and travel and to not feel quite so
right.
pegged to one place. At one point, Kate says, it's 1960 at this point in the narrative, and she says this about herself. She says she was a woman, so anything she did would be easier to fault and more dangerous too. What's the difference between being a white man and a white woman in North Carolina in 1960?
Well, I'm trying to fabricate that in the novel, and I'm trying to locate exactly where she says that. I think she's thinking about the risks of her potentially getting involved with the civil rights movement. Even just being friends with Gaines or speaking with him on the street. I mean, this isn't something a white woman did,
mm-hmm.
Interact like in that way. But regardless of where it is, she has this sense that I think is quite accurate, that if she steps outside the house, if she begins to take photographs, if she tries to sell them, if she gets engaged with something that's risky, if she speaks up in church, right, like Tacker does, if
yep.
she had done that, my goodness, what would have happened? But he's still viewed, even though in his mind he's fallen from this sort of pinnacle of the high school football star, in the eyes of the town, he's still quite the favored son.
Yep.
So he can get away with quite a lot, whereas she's really having to watch her step. And I mean, 1960, most women were still, as her friend and roommate does, still getting married
yep.
and having a family and picking out accessories for their kitchens. Right? I mean, is it going to be? I don't think you could get avocado green yet. Right? That might have been the mid-60s.
It was on the horizon.
No.
I talked a little bit earlier about how I see Tacker as a little more perhaps sensitive, perhaps vulnerable than he had been as a younger man. And at one point he says of himself, why did he care so much? Life would be so much easier if he could just forget about fairness. Is there a truth that I think maybe even applies as much now as it did then, that it's apathy that we have to worry about more than anything else?
Absolutely. And if it may ring in your ear or the readers, excuse me, the listeners, that the passage I read, the young African-American in the Greensboro sit-in says it's not fair that we can't sit down to eat. So this question of fairness, that we can't do the same things that white people are doing, it's a haunting prospect or question, I should say, for Tacker. How is he going to live knowing that things aren't fair?
Yeah.
What's he going to do about it? And he's had this experience in Nigeria in which, as the stranger, he was welcomed, right? He was brought into the community. And so here he is back at home, and the question is, are you going to welcome the stranger? Are you going to sit at the table with the other, the person who's been put in the position of the other? And are you going to commit yourself to making a change? And I think you're exactly right that that's still the question.
Yeah.
What are we doing, those of us who are white middle class, in our everyday lives that make a difference, that could or make a difference, or that don't? I mean, you'll remember you referred to Martin Luther King, and we recently celebrated or remembered the 50th anniversary of his death. And letter from Birmingham jail, he says it's not the KKK who's the obstacle. It's the moderate white person, right? We know where the KKK stands, but where does the moderate white person stand? Yeah.
Again, I look for sentences, and I'm not even going to ask you a question about this sentence. I'm just going to give it to our listeners because I think it describes both you and Tacker so well. And I can't remember who says this, but the sentence says, people who have lived deeply in two countries always bear the awareness of both. And to me, having read your other novel and having just really enjoyed sort of delving into this one, that sort of captures all of it, I think, for both you and for your main character.
I appreciate your reading that. Somebody wanted me to take it out and that it was a little too much like an authorial comment. And I thought, so be it. It is an authorial comment. And it's my book. And I kind of love it. And I believe it, too.
Yeah. I find it's interesting. Sometimes the things that, even things that I think seriously about editing out of a book, are often the ones that then readers come up to me and say, this is the passage that really resonated with me. So it's one of those things that you just had to put it out there and see how it lands
exactly.
in the world.
Exactly.
Yeah. We like to end every episode of Inside the Writer's Studio with the same 10 questions. They're all short answers. There's no grade, so you don't have to worry about this particular pop quiz, but hopefully they'll give us a little bit of insight into you and into your writing. So are you ready for the speed round?
Okay.
What word do you love to work into your writing?
Heterogeneous.
What word do you hate to encounter in other people's writing?
Gifted. No, what is it? She gifted me. But I think I'm thinking of students, so I need to think of something.
Oh, the students is fair. I think that's all right. I like that it comes from student writing.
That's okay.
Good. Where's your favorite place to write?
Probably at home in my studio.
Where could you never write?
I have learned to write everywhere.
To what rule of grammar do you pay least attention?
Well, I don't pay least attention to it, except I avoid it. I still can't figure out who and whom, so I'm always going around it.
What was the first book you remember reading?
Can I fudge on this one?
Sure.
The first book I remember is Peter and the Wolf, listened to on an LP, spooling out of that black disc. Yeah, in Nigeria in the night.
What are you reading now?
I am actually reading, because I'm getting ready to teach it, rereading The Roundhouse by Louise Erdrich. Mm.
What book would you like to have written?
I'm going to say West with the Night by Beryl Markham, because I would have liked to have been a flyer of airplanes in East Africa.
Yeah. What sort of book would you like to write but probably never will?
A travel guide.
And lastly, what would you like to hear a reader tell you?
I loved your book.
This has been Inside the Writer's Studio. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and the podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks, a literary nonprofit that runs the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas and operates a new community gathering place and independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. To find out more about Bookmarks and all its programs, visit www.bookmarksnc.org. My guest today has been Elaine Neal Orr, whose new novel, Swimming Between Worlds, is available wherever books are sold. Elaine, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Charlotte.
I'll be headed to England for a few weeks, but when I return, I'll be introducing you to a wonderful debut bookstore novel, Amy Meyerson's The Bookshop of Yesterdays. And who knows, we might even have a surprise episode from across the pond. Until then, thanks for listening, and may you read with wonder and write with passion.